Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Regular listeners know that I often observe that the fear and insecurity within each of us creates our own personal challenges, and moving through these obstacles is how we truly become who we are. Amy Edwards is a person who just keeps moving and defying fear and doubt. The result is a solid music career based in Austin, Texas, where she lives. She is a radio personality and podcaster, and now a novelist to inspire others. Today I talk with two artists who defy their boundaries and continue to expand their expression across form and media. We'll continue listening to the music of Amy Edwards, who first picked up a guitar at the age of 38 and has been rocking ever since, and we'll talk with her in just a minute. She's just published her first novel, The Trouble with Becoming a Witch. Her band is Amy and the Hi-Fis, and her podcasts are The Real Show and the just-launched Go Aff Yourself, which is all about affirmations. Later, we'll visit with poet, activist, dancer, and essayist Jenny Orvino, whose book, Poetry, Politics, and Passion, pulls the reader into Jenny's life in a way that will call you to reflect upon your own. So stay with us. It's what we do here. It's A Novel Idea.
Hey, girl, got your pink shoes on. Hey, girl, who says you can't have it all? They think so small, running women.
Been listening to Amy Edwards with her song Sell By. Amy has pushed through the boundaries in her own life and has made it her mission to inspire others to do the same with her music, her radio show and podcasts, and now through her novel, The Trouble with Becoming a Witch. The book is funny, honest, sometimes shocking, and all about what happens when a woman decides to stop living the life everyone expects of her and seizes the magic to become true to herself. Let's listen to our conversation. We do what we want, which is seems to be your theme song and mantra, maybe. And we're here today to talk with you about your novel, The Trouble with Becoming a Witch. But I thought it would be helpful for our listeners to find out a lot more about you. You are a musician, as you said, you are involved in radio, you have a podcast, and on your website you call yourself a motivational performer. So maybe let's start there.
I know, I have a lot of different titles, that's for sure. Yeah, I do. When I perform, I definitely try to incorporate the messages behind some of the songs, like the one you're referencing right there is a song called Sell By, which is just about, as women in particular, how many societal constructs or expectations are upon us. And I want to encourage people to break free of that. And, you know, the refrain in it is we do what we want, and it's just about living your life on your terms. And so when I perform, I definitely try to bring a spirit of that. So it's like walking a line between somewhere between, you know, speaker and musician kind of thing. So just because that's essentially who I am, I guess, I just want to be able to share the things I've learned with people and have it all mean something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And have you always lived your life that way, or it seems like you came into being a professional musician later in life than some, at least. And I'm wondering, and referring to your book a little bit too, that I'm wondering if you had any kind of personal epiphany or how you made transitions and reinventions in your own life.
I think it was very gradual. I'd love to say that it was just like all of a sudden an epiphany, you know, but it's just, it takes time and it takes baby steps and it all takes work to get to a place where just to grow, really. And that's been a part of my journey. But I did start music kind of late. I didn't start until about age 38. And I did it on a whim with some friends. And it just opened up a lot in my life as far as using my voice, both physically and metaphorically, using my voice to tell my story, to overcome fear and share that with the world and not be afraid. Be vulnerable enough not to be scared to tell that I had issues with it and that I had to work at it. And you know what I mean? Like, you have to, just being able to share all that is a vulnerable place to be, I guess is what I'm saying. So I think I kind of went off on a tangent. Sorry.
No, you know, I think you're right. And I think it seems like you are presenting yourself really as an example of the fact that we as people, but especially we as women, can make changes even if we are mothers. And in the book, The Trouble with Becoming a Witch, which mm-hmm. I think is your first novel. Is it your first novel?
It is, yes.
Yeah. The character in that book, Veronica, she's a mother, she's a wife, and she needs to make a change. And sometimes we have that inclination that something's not right, even when the exterior, you know, veneer of our life looks so right. We have a Lexus, we have a house, but it's still not who we are.
Right. Yes, it is. I mean, that's completely true. And I think that I have two daughters of my own, and I think that that's part of this whole growth process for me, to show that, yes, it's scary and it's hard, and, you know, you can feel pigeonholed into this certain mom role or whatever role it is, and people expect things of you, but we don't have to limit ourselves in that regard. And so I think having two daughters really pushes me to do these things and show them and model to them that you can do whatever you want. And, you know, I don't know what they're going to think of me when they grow up, but I hope that it sticks with them that, hey, you know what, my mom did it. So, you know, they know that women can grow into in all these different ways.
Yeah, one thinks that we have evolved and that we are living in a time where women can do whatever they want. But I think we only have to look around us to see. I mean, people, if we look even at our current presidential kind of, of election stuff, where people are still kind of afraid, I think, to put a woman out there.
I think so too. I was just out with some friends last night that are all my age and that I hadn't seen in a while, and we started discussing that exact thing, and how one of them was saying that she felt like we are a generation. I'm 47 years old now, so that our generation walks this line between still living in that sort of old-fashioned way. We weren't burning bras or anything like that. We were still kind of under these expectations, though, from our parents. And then we're also, like, with this, the younger pool is more open and more willing to change and more willing to accept women putting themselves out there in whatever way they want to. So, yeah, it could be. I hope that it's changing, you know. I think we're all wanting that change. It's just challenging, especially in this climate.
I know. And speaking of climates, are you, is your home base there, and are you speaking to us today from Austin?
I am. I'm in Austin, Texas, and it's about 100 degrees outside right now.
Well, I hope that you will make it out to Sonoma County, California sometime and visit us and bring your music too. And before we talk any more about the book, I really do want to talk a little bit about your music. And
okay.
Because I had the pleasure of listening to some of your music, and for maybe coming to now, I'm going to ask you, are these a lot of original tunes, or do you work with somebody?
I write everything. Yes, I do. But I do have a close relationship with my producer, AJ Vallejo. And so for the last albums, Magic albums, we co-produced those and worked together very closely to make those.
Because I found that many of the songs, just even after one listening, had a very memorable melody and message. And
thank you. That makes me feel really good. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Were you, like, for years and years stuffing this stuff, and then it's been an outpouring of expression?
I don't know. I think that I guess I just wasn't embracing any creative outlet to put things out, and it's scary to put out a song at all and to be honest and to do it, because and the book is the same way. It's scary when you put yourself into something and then you go like, okay, everybody check this out, and you may hate it, you know. And so I think there's like a whole overcoming fear thing around putting out anything creative. And I don't know, before, I think that I just didn't even think of it as an option. And once I did think of it as like, oh, I could do this, then I did it, you know? And so I've really embraced the opportunity to creatively express myself. Yeah.
Well, did you like take piano lessons when you were a kid or something? Because
I did a little when I was a kid, and then I was in choir and stuff, but really, I really didn't play music until I picked up the guitar. And I started with electric, and just with some friends, we were just playing cover songs. And I really took to it quickly and just really liked it. But I didn't know how to songwrite. I didn't really know anything about it. Kathy Valentine lives here in Austin, and she is the bassist for the Go-Go's and wrote a lot of their songs. And she, somehow we met Kathy, and I had the wonderful opportunity to write some songs with her. And I felt like I learned a ton about songwriting real fast. And then I also worked with, once I got on my own, I worked with another producer, Dwight Baker, and he taught me a lot about songwriting. Like just working with those people who know what they're doing and know how to crack the whip and be like, just write like you talk, you know? And so it's a skill like anything else that you just like writing. It's just like writing. Like the more you do it, the easier it gets. And then you can just sit down and do it. I also am a member of a few songwriting groups where we will have a deadline and we will just, you'll have to just crank out a song. And so that's really helpful. And, you know, I just keep it real simple. A lot of times I'll just play simple chords on the guitar. And I have taken lessons off and on over the years in guitar. I try to practice several times a week, at least, if not every day. And then I take voice lessons religiously every single week, because training my voice is crucial to me, not only for singing, but for the voice work or radio stuff that I do too. So, yeah.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about that work and your own podcast that maybe okay. some of our listeners will want to jack into?
I've had a podcast since 2015 called The Real Show. And I was friends with some guys who have a sound company here in Austin. And they said, we're starting a podcast studio. We want some beta testers. Will you do it? And I just jumped in and said yes. And I learned a ton about podcasting from them. But once I started having to pay for their the use of their space, I was like, I need to do this on my own. So I just, it's been a little spotty, and it's been a learning curve with the podcast. And I, you know, produce it all myself and do the whole thing myself. And I really enjoyed that. I recently ended The Real Show, but there's tons of great content on there. Last year, I did a series on affirmations. And that was really profound in my life. And I've gotten a lot out of that. And a lot of people, gave me some good feedback on what it meant to them. So I would recommend those. And I ended it because I just felt like I needed to start something new in my life right now. So I'm moving forward. We're spinning off the Affirmations podcast into one called Go Aff Yourself. And then personally, I'm still sorting out exactly what I want to do, along with like my messages, Rock Your Life, which is about making change and living your dreams. So I'm going to do something around that. And I haven't fully grasped what that's going to look like quite yet. But I do enjoy podcasting and radio and all that. So I'm working at a radio station here in Austin now called Austin 360 Radio, which is with the Austin American Statesman. So I'm on air every day from 12 to 3.
And is it a music show or a talk show?
It's a mix. We're a funk station, but we pull in a lot of writers from the Austin American Statesman, and we talk about local events, what's going on, and then I have a lot of freedom to talk about, whatever it is I want to talk about, whether it's, you know, how I'm feeling that day or, you know, strength or fear or whatever it is. So that's been nice. And we release those as podcasts as well.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about a YouTube video that I saw on your song, Your Backyard. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do a lot of work with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, which is a nonpartisan grassroots organization working toward more sensible gun laws in the United States. And before I got involved with Moms Demand, it was after the Sandy Hook shooting. I really wanted to do something. My daughter came home from school and had a lockdown drill. And so I really went there in my mind and imagined what the lockdown is like, and what if an active shooter was in her school. And I didn't know what to do. So I get a little, even just talking about this, I get a little choked up. That song means a lot to me. I guess I was just mad at myself about waiting to get involved. So I wrote the song about that. Like, why do we have to wait for something? I was asking myself, am I waiting for her to get shot? Am I waiting for a tragedy in order to get involved with something like this? And so I decided I didn't want to wait. And so the message was, why does it have to be in your backyard for it to really matter? Why does it have to hit close to home, you know? And I just felt like it was kind of a message to our lawmakers as well. Like, what are they waiting for exactly? I just don't understand. So yeah. And then the day we shot the video for it, there was another school shooting, another mass shooting that day. That was maybe 2017, I can't remember. And there was a shooting in Alpine, Texas. So, you know, it's just an unfortunate reality that we're living in, but we're working on changing it. And that was part of my contribution.
It is something that you would think that children having to live in fear, how can they not, when they're doing duck and cover drills in school and lock your door drills in school?
Yeah.
I mean, how can our children grow up outside of this shell of fear when that fear is really all around us?
I know. And you just want to change that. So I'm trying, you know, it's a marathon.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to the book.
Okay. Let's talk about the book.
The Trouble with Becoming a Witch. Well, I'm going to digress one more time.
Okay.
It is published by She Writes Press, and I keep interviewing authors and reading their books, and it's She Writes Press.
Really? That's so cool.
It is really amazing that the caliber of authors coming out of there. And I know how they nurture and create a wonderful environment for publication. And this is your first novel. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experience with She Writes Press.
I'm such a fan of Brooke Warner, who is in charge around there. And she's just fantastic. I got to meet her in person at the Book Expo this year. And I have a children's book out as well that came out this year. And like, it's been a really positive experience all the way around with She Writes. I was searching for something like them and felt very lucky to find them and connect, and they accepted my book. And so I don't have a basis for comparison, though. I should probably say that. Like, the book industry is very new to me, and it is very specific, very niche, and very a really large industry that I know nothing about. So it's been really a positive first experience, for sure. And I would recommend anybody to look into them.
Well, I think you've landed in a good place.
Thank you.
Okay, The Trouble with Becoming a Witch.
Yes.
It's somewhat about magic, but really the magic of becoming yourself.
Exactly. It's a metaphor for change, really. And it's a metaphor for how it's about how any time we change ourselves, it can make the ones around us uncomfortable, and it can force some hard things out. That's really what it's about. The trouble of becoming anything, the trouble with changing ourselves or transforming ourselves, means that other things change, including important relationships in our lives. And that's hard. That's really hard. And it's coming at a time for me where I have been very obsessed with transformation. Last year, I transformed everything in my life. The magic albums that I did a double album that came out last year, and it is about transformation. It's called Magic, and it's about using our own magic to transform anything in our lives. So that's been a big theme with me, and this book just falls right in line with that. And having transformed, I don't know what I was going to say there. I kind of lost my train of thought. But yes, that is what it is about. Yeah.
Well, the character in the book, Veronica, has thoughts that sometimes I think when we have thoughts that are like, God, I wish he would just drop dead, that, you know, we feel shameful about sometimes.
Yeah.
or thinking,
yeah.
Oh, God. But sometimes those are real and they're telling us something, and we need to listen and not be afraid. And it seems like that's her struggle in the book, is to break through the perhaps inertia of her current life to get to her unknown, perhaps, but to be free to be who she is.
Absolutely. And I know that I've spent a ton of time in my life, you know, upholding others' expectations and the role that they see you playing, which we were talking about earlier. And so it's just about, like, living on your own terms, whatever that may be, you know?
And I think that the title, you know, sometimes we as women are called witches when we are doing something that people don't like. And yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And she is involved in a relationship where her husband is trying to define her. And certainly that happens in a lot of relationships. And sometimes in relationships we get through that, and sometimes we don't. And so I found the book kind of fun and interesting, and a little bit I kept waiting for other shoes to drop. So I thought for your first novel, I thought it had some great pacing to it, and
thank you.
And was surprising.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me, because I have moments where it's just like I was saying about putting anything creative out. You're like, oh my gosh, now this is for real. People are going to read this. You know, it's a little nerve wracking, and you just have to find your zen space around it. And go, it's okay. You know what? It's going to be fine. You put it out and then you keep going. So
absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that.
Well, you are a real example to us of transformation, because you not only have done it in your own life, but in such a public way with your music and podcasting and now this book. Amy Edwards, I'm so happy to talk to you. And I think our listeners need to, and readers need to, pick up your book and listen to your music while reading
it.
Thank
you. Yes, thank you so much. And, I really appreciate it, Suzanne.
And I hope that you'll stop by when, I mean, do you tour with your group?
You know what? Not that much right now, but we're hoping to make it out to California for sure. So,
well, stop in here.
I will be in touch if we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Amy Edwards, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing about the book.
That was my conversation with Amy Edwards, and her novel is The Trouble with Becoming a Witch, published by She Writes Press. Amy has a double album out, Magic, Volumes 1 and 2, and the children's book she co-authored is Starla and the Boogie Deluxe. Let's take a break with Amy singing Your Backyard from her EP Little Birds. Stay with us. It's a novel idea.
Laser blowing down the street. I went to the usual spot where we'd meet.
Edwards with Your Backyard. I am Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. I characterize Jenny Orvino as a literary dancer who moves through mediums with ease, has a Grammy-nominated spoken word CD, Make Love, Not War, has won awards for her poetry, is a citizen activist with some of the most articulate commentary I've encountered, and her memoir, Poetry, Politics, and Passion, is an expression that is challenging, funny, sexy, and frank. Let's listen to my conversation with Jenny Orvino. When you were 22 years old, you said, "I believe my purpose in life is to write poetry and to work for peace." And threaded through your book, it seems that you've held true to that in a fluid way, and that it's been your life's journey. Why don't you talk about that purpose in life, that 22-year-old Jenny talking about her purpose in life?
It's amazing that the 22-year-old is not that much different from the 65-year-old in some ways, which surprised me. Hopefully I'm more mature. But when I had a personal coach a couple of years ago, and he was asking me what I thought my mission was, I was trying to see if there was something that I could say that was different from that. And I really couldn't come up with anything. It seems that that held true. I pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the world. I listen to alternative media and I read. I don't feel that I'm so much of an out-in-the-street activist as I used to be. I feel that my activism comes from and within the writing more than anything else now.
Though when you were 20, 22, a young woman, you dove in a way that was unabashed, it seemed, into that was a very vibrant time in the late 60s.
Well, 1968 was such a pivotal year, the summer of love and all. And I was graduating from college at that time. So it was an exciting time. I went to an all-girls Catholic college. Now, people would think, oh, that is so conservative, and how could you come out of there being a political activist? But that was my incubation. That was my grounding, because I was hanging out with the radical left of the church, the Father Daniel and Phil Berrigans, the people who felt that their conscience was what was leading them to what they did in the world, their moral conscience, the gospel, Gandhi. So in a way, maybe if I had gone to a more secular university, I wouldn't have had the same convictions that I had as a result of going to Catholic school as I did.
I related so much with your book when I picked it up and read it. I felt like it. I had some similar experiences. I went to a small Mennonite college, and it also was the same sort of incubation of introducing me to concepts that helped provide a language for maybe unformed things in me.
And the opportunity for leadership, too, when there were no boys in class to compete with or to look coy for. The women who were my role models were my classmates, my hall proctor who introduced me to radical ideas. When I was a freshman, and she was a senior. The terrific priests who were our chaplains.
I wonder where some of that leadership is now in the church.
Well, it seems to me they've gone backwards since John 23.
It does seem that way.
I mean, we've gone backwards in a lot of ways. I feel like today we're fighting for things that we accomplished years ago. And
why do you think that is?
I think corporate money, corporate takeover. You know, colonialism.
Holding hands, strolling home, remembering a day 30 years before when this came my way.
You talk a lot about
this. The flagpole got shot himself. Us little ones confused, sheltered from this hell. My heart breaks because nothing's really changed. It's elementary, my dear. Your own personal shooting.
I think all children of the 60s had a generational conflict. We were reacting to the 50s. Feminism was a reaction to those times. We were responding to the draft and the war. And in a way, we couldn't help it. It was thrust upon us in a very big way. I think What's happening these days is that so many people are not affected by what is going on elsewhere in the world. We have only a small segment of the poor and others who have been returning to these wars for multiple deployments and who are getting shot up and their lives destroyed and their families destroyed. But the majority of people are not directly affected. We don't have a draft. Every single young man doesn't have to make a decision about what is he going to do. Is he going to register? Is he going to go to jail? Is he going to go to Canada? Those were critical decisions for every man of 18 years old when I was 18 years old. And that is not happening now. And I think that is a big difference. There we have a, you know, not only is there the 1% and the percent of the 1% that has the control of the wealth, but there's also the privilege of not having to do the dirty work.
And those times are threaded through your narrative, through your memoir. It was such a time of aliveness and charting your own course in a way. And you met some pretty interesting people. You were really at the nexus of a lot of activity. And I felt like as I was reading your book and all these names popping up in very intimate ways, why don't you talk about some
of
these relationships?
Well, I hope that it doesn't sound like name dropping. But in a certain way, the people that I met were my teachers and role models along the way. My first boyfriend was a draft resister. He went to jail for refusing induction. And so I wrote a little essay called Girls Say Yes to Boys Who Say No, which was a quote from Joan Baez, who at the time her husband, David Harris, went to jail for refusing to go to war. And so I don't know. It's not that I followed her advice, but in a sense, I was attracted to activist men, men of conscience. And my first boyfriend, Bob, I was able to follow him in a certain way. Granada Television made a documentary about him, and I would show that film to various groups and talk about it. The wonderful poet Denise Levertov took that film and showed it on the East Coast because she was a member of Resist at the time, and they were a group of adults who supported young draft resistors. Her husband was in the Dr. Spock trial. He was one of the defendants in that trial for supporting young draft resistors. So I did meet celebrities in a sense, but they were celebrities like the poets who were traveling the country doing readings, poetry readings against the war. And so that's how I met Robert Bly. So I have a section in my memoir about Bly, and I was able years later, 30 years later, to interview Robert Bly for this radio station. So some of those relationships stayed over the course of years.
There was, in your book, a real sweetness about that relationship, it seemed.
And the same thing happened with the radical lawyer, William Kunstler, who defended the Milwaukee 14, who were 14... priests. I mean, it had a nonviolent, religiously moral basis. That act of, we are going to pour napalm on draft files. We're going to pour blood on draft files as an act of conscience to illicit, and we're willing to go to jail in order to put this in the public eye. We were very conscious of media at the time to try to get the anti-war message out into the public. And so I met William Kunstler because he was defending them. Then he subsequently defended the Chicago 7, which was a, you know, very famous big media trial. And I had the fortunate opportunity, I guess, to become intimate with him for a little while, which for, you know, a 23-year-old, it was a pretty spectacular experience. And then my daughter's father, my actually my first husband, not the same person as the draft resister, but he also refused induction and had to face that. And he decided to face it in a different way, which was not to go to jail, not to go to Canada, but to fail his physical and to abuse his body to such a point that he failed his physical and was able to get out of the Army that way. So there were many ways that people were trying to not serve, and it seems that I met a lot of them and was involved with them.
Well, you bring up your relationship with William Kunstler, and that too is something that is threaded throughout the story, your own sexual exploration and expression, and I'll say even advocacy of just even the frankness with which you talk about it, not only in your memoir, but in many of the other activities you've been involved with. And some people might be shocked by that even now, yet it seems like something that emerged out of those times.
I did a reading recently where one of the audience members said, you know, when I was listening to you, I didn't feel uncomfortable or voyeuristic. I just felt like you were sharing your insight and experience with me, and that included me rather than put me off. And so I felt very enlightened by all your writings about sexuality. And that is a topic. Sexuality and relationships is a topic that I'm extremely interested in. And my spoken word CD, which is called Make Love Not War, I made that CD in 2002. And it was a hard marketing sell because the erotic bookstores and the sensuality shop and so on did not want to sell it because it was too political. And the political bookstores did not want to sell it because it was too erotic. But what the CD is a combination of anti-war poems and erotica. And the way I put them together is you can transform the world from the body. And that if we could just, I know somebody once said, maybe if those dictators had a more loving more loving relationships, they might not be so able to kill and torture people. So,
well, I think about the matriarchal bonobos that really use sexual pleasure as a means of communication and to defray tension, especially among the males in their community. Yet now I think we're looking at these animals a little differently, but sometimes I wonder if they've not been examined the same way as chimpanzees or gorillas because people are afraid of it. I don't know. But in your book, you do really, I'm going to say, naturalize. The conversation is very easy and natural. And I found that engaging in a way, well, that I appreciated. And I think our readers will, too, just in the same way this person talked to you at your reading.
Well, I've always been trying to tread that line between what is erotic and what is pornographic? What is enlightening and what is offensive? And just trying to find where that space is, especially because as a woman, I have not enjoyed very much, quote, pornography or what passes for erotic literature or erotic films. And so I thought, well, if I don't like what other people are doing, then I should just do it myself and try to write about topics like masturbation, all the no-nos, just to say, well, this is what it's about, and this is how I feel most alive. I mean, the goddess gave me sexuality to get me through how difficult this life is, you know?
Well, I thank you for your conversation in the book that way. I thought it was great, and I think sometimes we avoid the conversation when it is something we all have in common and yet somehow feel that it has to be pornographic or hidden some way. I mean, and I think even when you talk about yourself as a child, I think children, probably it's a very natural thing for children to be exploring themselves and giving themselves pleasure, yet it's not what we're supposed to be doing.
No, my grandmother caught me tickling my cookie, right? And you're not supposed to do that. And I didn't know why, but I knew it was something bad, but it didn't stop me from doing it.
Well, it's pretty hard. And you just used a phrase, tickling your cookie, and you have a poem in your book that I really loved. Do you want to read it now? That
Words They Gave Us.
Words They Gave Us, that I thought was kind of a good take on just what we're talking about.
Words They Gave Us. Scratched on lavatory walls, chalked on concrete bridges, whispered in my ear when I picked up a midnight telephone. Pussy, slit, beaver, muff, box, hair pie. Even a sweetheart struggles to find a phrase that doesn't blunt the sensual edge. Heart of the peony, jade gate, cinnabar cave, whisper this to me, anemone of Venus, ripe peach, lotus flower, little bell. Praise yoni, the vulva, adorned with a ring of gold. Spray paint fences and billboards with what my lover calls her, cookie, rosebud, velvet valentine.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your process of writing. And you're a poet, and I think you mentioned someplace, maybe on your website or in your book, that you, from an early age, considered yourself a writer and have obviously been writing poetry your whole life.
I got a diary when I was 12 or 13 years old with a lock and key, and I used to write in my diary, and I still keep a journal. I have boxes and boxes of journals. So journal writing, that kind of writing, not necessarily for publication, has been really useful in my life. And I think journal writing can be good for everybody. Writer or not a writer, it just helps you clear your head, understand yourself. By comparing old journals, you can see the progress you've made. When I was writing the memoir, I used the journal to do research and to find out, well, when did such and such a thing happen and what happened first, second, and third? So journal writing is one thing. My first poems were, of course, unrequited love poems, where you're writing about, you know, the guy in eighth grade when you're in sixth grade, and, you know, he's the football hero or the star or whatever, and you write about that. I think I'm actually rather neurotic about my writing when I'm writing for getting a finished piece. I mean, I would think I would write, you know, one or two poems a year, and I hear about people who are writing poems every day, and then I start feeling inferior and, oh, I'm not producing, and so on and so forth. But I mean, I've been trying to relax about writing and say there's no obligation. I'm not a vending machine where you put in the quarter and the poem comes out, or you put in, you know, a dollar and a chapter of a novel comes out or something. That is not the way it goes. I mean, I have to be pretty worked up usually to write about something. And if there's one thing that I want to encourage anybody to, is to really try to give yourself nourishment, give your inner artist nourishment so that you can. Because I think humans were made to be creative. I mean, if we're made in the image of what created the universe, it's all about creating. And that's, I mean, self-expression is what we're here for, I feel. So when I'm doing some kind of creative work, it doesn't necessarily have to be writing or painting. I mean, just being out in the garden this morning and watering and looking at the tomatoes and talking to the flowers, that just made me feel so much in my soul self, in who I am. And I think it is about creative, making something beautiful, making a beautiful home, making a beautiful garden, making a beautiful meal. I love to cook, and it's sort of the same process.
And your book is Poetry, Politics, and Passion, Memoir, Poems, Personal Essays by Jenny Arvino. And it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful cover. Can you tell our listeners something about the cover art?
The cover art is from a large painting by Brad Huck, who's a longtime friend of mine, now lives in Maui, on the island of Maui. And in fact, he did the cover for my spoken word CD and also for the book of poetry previous to that, Heart of the Peony. So I have been using Brad's artwork. And what the covers are reproductions of huge paintings that he has done.
Well, it's beautiful. And I do want to mention again your spoken word CD, your Grammy-nominated spoken word CD, Make Love, Not War, Poems of Peace and Passion. And you can get that on CD Baby.
Yes.
Maybe we could do a reading or two to give the listeners a flavor of you, your writing, and your life.
Well, the only thing I wanted to say about this, the structure of the book, the memoir operates in kind of a spiral format so that I go back and forth in time and I come back to the certain themes. Like I will introduce my relationship with my parents, and then, you know, four little sections later, I'll bring in a little more about my relationship with my parents, and then it continues through. And each time that I brought up a certain topic, whether it was Bob Gillum and his draft resistance or Bill Kunstler or whatever, I added a little bit of information. And so by the time the whole thing was finished, I really feel that it all came together and that the structure was understandable. And then the poems I chose and the essays that I chose all had to do with, well, how poetry, politics, and passion have intersected in my life.
And I'll say about the memoir section that in some ways I felt it functioned very much like reminiscence does, of maybe being steeped in a moment and emerging into the present and with a little bit of reflexiveness to it. And so I think that structure did help me get to know you through your work. Do you want to read a little bit?
Sure. I'll just start with just the very first page and read the epigram, which is from a song by the Indigo Girls called Let It Be Me. And the words are, if the world is night, shine my life like a light. September 23rd, 1968. It was my second Sunday in Milwaukee, a warm morning, as I headed to St. John's with a group of clergy and lay people who had been meeting all week to compose a statement urging the Catholic Church to actively resist war and racism. My shoulder bag was heavy with leaflets to pass out to congregants on their way in. I handed off the bag, however, before we got in sight of the big downtown cathedral. I was one of those designated to dress conservatively to attend the Mass and demonstrate from inside. Just before the sermon, our undercover contingent rose from our pews and walked in silence past the communion rail into the sanctuary. At first, our action was met with murmurs, and then the voices became louder, echoing from all sides, "Sit down and be quiet." Our spokesperson faced the congregation. With 15 of us lined up beside him, he attempted to read our request for the Archbishop to speak out against the Vietnam War. The previously serene churchgoers wagged their fingers and interrupted repeatedly. Then they left their seats to stand in front of us, continuing to holler, "Love it or leave it! Communists!" We decided to read in unison so they couldn't drown out our words and quickly passed around copies of our statement. The paper trembled in my hands and my voice sounded hoarse. I remember a woman yelling inches away from my face, and I responded by kissing her on the cheek. I noticed her clip earring, felt her silky face powder, not unlike my grandmother's. It was scary. It was exhilarating. Our friend, Nick Rydell, assistant pastor at another church in the diocese, attempted to ascend the speaking pulpit. Even though he had donned his rarely worn Roman collar for this occasion, Father Rydell was barred from the microphone by uniformed police who emerged from the sacristy. Apparently, they had been called in advance. The officers and church authorities formed a solid phalanx at the rear and herded us back through the opening in the altar rail. The assembly voiced their approval. But as soon as all the demonstrators had been forced into their pews, something possessed me to stand up again. It was an adrenaline-fueled impulse. Angry that our protest had not gone as planned, I strode back to the altar steps and sat down, alone. A distressed "ooh" rose from the congregation. My comrades rushed to join me. There was a tumult of vestments, altar boys, parishioners, and police before my world went paisley red with pain. I was picked up from the floor by two index fingers pressed behind my ears. One burly cop used that neat trick of persuasion as he and his partner ushered me down the aisle and out a side door. I lost a shoe along the way. As in an old-time Western movie where a guy comes flying through the saloon's double doors and the bouncer wipes his hands clean of the character, I was dumped. By sheer luck, I was not arrested, as those who followed my example were. The next day, both the Morning Milwaukee Sentinel and the Afternoon Milwaukee Journal had the same photo on the front page. Miss Orvino, wearing a floral print sundress, hustled out of St. John's in the grip of two uniformed officers, her face contorted and her one stockinged foot pawing the air.
Jenny Orvino reading from her memoir, Poetry, Politics, and Passion. Jenny, I just have to make this observation. Several times in the book, there is a little bit of a recurring theme of you saying, "And I don't know what possessed me to," and then you launch off from there. So I trust that, that's an impulse that remains to this day.
I'm afraid so.
Okay. Well, I just want to say thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
I've been talking with Jenny Orvino. Her memoir is Poetry, Politics, and Passion. I encourage you to discover her blogs at jennyorvino.com. Earlier, we heard from another rock-your-life type of woman, Amy Edwards, and we've been listening to her music today. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. I have production assistance from Sean Knight, Mark Prell, and Anthony Garcia. This is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB-FM. Subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. It's a novel idea.